So it's time for sharing the Dhamma. As usual, we'll begin with the recitation of the Namo Tassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Namo Tassa Bhagavato Arahato Samma Sambuddhassa. Today, I will speak about freedom. Freedom is something extremely precious. It is hard to come by, and it is easily lost again. Living in a democratic country like the USA or Canada, you may take this freedom for granted. You know, the freedom of assembly, the freedom of belief, religion, the freedom of speech, the freedom of the press, the freedom of movement or travel, or the freedom of thought. You know, the history of mankind can also be described as the struggle of people to become free. For example, to become free from oppressing rulers, to become free from slavery, or to become free from racial discrimination, or to become free from domestic violence, or to become free from unjust laws and regulations. Some of these struggles for greater freedom or independence have been successful. People nowadays enjoy greater levels of freedom, at least in democratic countries or constitutional monarchies. Freedom of speech or freedom of the press are available to many people on this earth, although not to everybody on this planet. There has been much progress in regard to the personal freedom that people enjoy nowadays. But still, many people are not yet free. And even those who consider themselves to be free human beings, they are still chained by invisible chains. And still nowadays, the calls for freedom can be heard almost from every corner in this world. Just to mention a couple of them. For example, the call for freedom of the Tibetan people. And this has been an ongoing issue since the brutal invasion of China in Tibet. As we know, this has resulted in a genocide and the destruction or almost destruction of their culture. Many of the monasteries have been destroyed. And still nowadays, China is not loosening its grip on this once independent country. Or else, there is the struggle for gender equality carried out by feminists all around the world. You know, for example, Switzerland, which is considered to be free and democratic countries. It was only in 1971 that women got the right to vote. In comparison, in New Zealand, it was in 1893 that the women got the right to vote. Or in Australia, it was in 1902, or Germany, 1918. And I found out in the USA, it was in 1920. Even in a country such as Turkey, the women got the right to vote in 1934. But in Switzerland, it lasted until 1971. Quite amazing. So the calls for more freedom seem to be never ending. People's wish for freedom was as strong at the time of the Buddha as it is nowadays. And in response to this deep-seated wish to become free, the Buddha offered the Dhamma as a means to achieve complete freedom, complete inner freedom. And because the Dhamma is timeless, it is as applicable today as it was 25 centuries ago. Although the Buddha was teaching at the time when the political and social structures were quite different from nowadays, his teaching aims to liberate the human heart and mind from all that keeps it in bondage, or it aims at the deep transformation of the heart and mind so that one can free oneself from these invisible chains. You know, nowadays, the political and social landscapes have changed in many places around the world. But the nature of the human mind has not changed. That's still the same. The Buddha has described the Dhamma as follows. Just as the great ocean has but one taste, namely the taste of salt, even so this Dhamma has but one taste, the taste of liberation. And so with these words, the Buddha assured us of the liberating quality of his teaching. So the practice of the Dhamma leads to liberation, to freedom. This we are told time and again. And whoever practices the Dhamma, puts it into actual practice, can taste this liberating quality. And this was not only said by the Buddha, but it has been said by many teachers throughout the ages up to this present day. You know, whether you just drink a tiny little sip of ocean water, or whether you drink a glass full of ocean water, whether you drink a whole bucket full of ocean water, the taste is the same, salty. And so likewise with the Buddha's teaching, a single taste pervades its teaching, the taste of freedom, the taste of liberation. And this can be experienced at the different levels of the Buddha's teaching, engaging in different areas. It can already be experienced at the basic level of practicing generosity, or by doing acts of devotion, or by ethical conduct, by keeping the precepts. This taste of liberation can also be gained, experienced at the intermediate level when one is engaging in meditation practice. Or it can be experienced at the top level when past knowledge is realized, like with any one of the stages of enlightenment. So in all of these different experiences, one can taste liberation or a greater sense of freedom. We know that at the time of the Buddha, there were many other spiritual teachers in ancient India. And the Buddha was well aware that other spiritual teachers were also teaching ways to liberation. The Buddha did not deny this, but the Buddha simply pointed out that their kind of liberation or freedom was not the all-encompassing liberation of freedom that he, the Buddha, had attained. So at one time, the Buddha said, "There are some ascetics and Brahmins who preach liberation. They praise liberation in various ways. But in regard to the highest Aryan liberation, I do not see any who have surpassed me in this." So with this statement, you know, to me, the Buddha was not wanting to show off or to brag. He simply stated a fact. A teaching that comes with the promise of complete and all-encompassing freedom is, of course, very attractive. This is what people want. And especially since it is said that basically everybody can achieve this state of complete liberation. However, when people come to the Dhamma, they very soon hear that the way to liberation also involves discipline, restraint, and self-control. Hearing that such qualities are needed on the way to liberation, this often dampers their initial enthusiasm and interest because this was not what they were looking for. To many people, this not only seems to be a contradiction, but to them it seems to be a stumbling block. People then ask themselves, how can freedom be achieved when I have to restrain myself? Or this self-control is just another prison I have to set up for myself. Or how can I become free when I have to restrain my actions of body, speech, and thought? But the confusion lies in the fact that there are two kinds of freedom. One kind of freedom is the freedom as license. And the other kind of freedom is freedom as a spiritual autonomy or as a mastery over one's inner condition. And of course, many people identify freedom with freedom of license. For them, freedom means the license to freely act out their impulses, their moods, their wants, desires, rejections, and so on. To be free, so they think they must be able to do what they want, they must be able to say what they want, and they must be able to think what they want. And therefore, any restriction laid upon this license is seen as an encroachment upon their freedom. The freedom that the Buddha was referring to is, of course, as you may guess, not this freedom of license. The Buddha pointed to a spiritual freedom. And this spiritual freedom is an internal autonomy of the mind that results from the destruction of the defilements, anything that causes distress, suffering. You can also say it is the liberation of the conditioned and compulsive patterns of the mind. The liberation of one's conditioned behavior. This spiritual freedom has been exemplified by many people throughout the ages. And these women and men have shown that the mind free from these tormenting and oppressing defilements, they experience a degree of freedom that is unequaled. And even if such people are imprisoned, they are still experiencing a greater degree of freedom than the so-called free citizens, who are actually prisoners of their mental conditioning. For example, after the brutal crushdown of the demonstrations in Yangon, Burma, in 1988, many of the members of the NLD, the National League for Democracy, were put into prison or put under house arrest. And one of these persons was a man called Uchi Maun. So he was under house arrest, and although his outer freedom was curtailed, his mind was still free. He was very careful to not let his mind become imprisoned by the actions that the government had taken against him. He compared the military in general and the soldiers who were outside of his house, in particular, as hunters. At one time, Alan Clements was able to do some interviews with members of the NLD. And so in this interview with Alan Clements, Uchi Maun said this: "Imagine the consciousness of a hunter who is all the time anxiously peeping around and suspiciously listens to every sound. His mind is set to conquer and kill. This is a truly deploring and regrettable state of mind. For this reason, all the soldiers in front of my house remind me constantly to eat my meal slowly and peacefully. I am not in a hurry. I enjoy my freedom, not tomorrow, but today." Another member of the NLD was put into prison. He was there for many years. He was also very careful not to let his mind be overcome with habitual unwholesome patterns. He tried to see the wardens and officers in the prison, not to see them as his enemies, as one usually would do, but he tried to see them as his friends. So he tried to prevent that his mind was overcome with feelings of enmity, aversion, or hatred towards people who simply had to do their duty working in the prison. And talking also to Alan Clements, this man, whose name is U Tin U, he said, "During that time in prison, I made it a habit to practice generosity. I offered them, the wardens and the officers in the prison, I offered them some of the food that my wife brought me here into the prison. With this act of generosity, I wanted to prevent any notion of seeing them as my enemies. So I usually shared some of my food with them. They too had a hard life in prison, even though they were only working there and not being imprisoned." And we have heard similar accounts of Tibetan people, lay people, nuns and monks, who had spent many years in Chinese prisons. Although they lacked any personal and outer freedom, their minds were still free, sometimes under the most trying conditions. Even the most severe tortures could not break their minds, or their hearts could never be put into chains. So whenever I hear such accounts, I have a tremendous respect for these people. What they were able to do, what they still are able to do, this is by no means a piece of cake. It shows a deep understanding of the Dhamma and also a great restraint and self-control, not giving in to unwholesome thoughts or emotions. And so the result is a degree of inner freedom that is hard to come by. So put in simple terms, there are two areas that we must pay attention to, because they usually obstruct the attainment of freedom or to be free. The Buddha pointed out three kinds of feeling tones, vedanas, pleasant ones, unpleasant ones, and neutral ones, those which are neither painful nor pleasant. And as we know, each experience, be it a bodily experience, a mental experience, each experience is accompanied by a vedana, by a feeling tone. So it's impossible to experience anything in the body, heart, and mind without a feeling tone, without a vedana. Then the other area is, the Buddha also singled out three mental factors that are the subjective counterparts of these three kinds of Vedana. And he called them anusaya, the latent tendencies or latent defilements. And these latent tendencies lie dormant in the continuum of the mind. They are latent, they are dormant, but they're always ready to kind of wake up and manifest, either in the mind or as action of body and speech. And these three mental factors, or these three latent tendencies, are greed, hatred, and delusion. The three main defilements, or the three poisons. Then the Buddha went on to say that a worldling, and he used the word worldling for a person who has not yet attained a stage of enlightenment. So he said that when a worldling experiences a pleasant feeling, then the latent tendency to greed springs up in response. So, you know, whenever some object hits one of the sense doors, seeing something, hearing something, a mental object. So when there's a pleasant feeling accompanying it, then this latent defilement to greed springs up, manifests first of all on the level of the mind. And the Buddha then also said, when a worldling experiences an unpleasant feeling tone, then the latent tendency to aversion springs up. And when a worldling experiences a neutral feeling, then the latent tendency to ignorance springs up. And the Buddha said that these three latent tendencies, these anusaya, they will persist in the mind forever if nothing is done to weaken them or to completely overcome them. And we must know that with the experience of past knowledge, any stage of enlightenment, this is such a powerful experience because at that moment, some of the defilements are completely uprooted in the mind. And then they are simply no longer there. So it is possible to uproot these latent tendencies. But before we get to that stage, we can weaken them. We can be mindful, as I said before, like what kind of Vedana is arising and, you know, what the immediate reaction to it is, but then not acting it out. So as I mentioned before, the first step is to be aware of the feeling tone, and it is to be aware of what reaction comes up in the mind. You know, this of course is much better than not being aware on the one hand of the feeling tone and not being aware of the reaction that has come up. So this is very important, very crucial in our practice. This is a first necessary step. But if we want to become completely free, completely liberated, then we must go further. We really must completely uproot these latent tendencies from our mind. Because as long as they are there, we are not completely free. We know from our personal experience that these latent tendencies, these habitual patterns, reactions, are deeply ingrained in our mind. You know, these are kind of the conditioned responses to sense impressions. And, you know, one area in our day-to-day life where we can notice quite easily and quite obviously these conditioned patterns and responses is around food. That's a rich field to observe, you know, the arising of vedanas, feeling tones, and then the immediate habitual reaction. This conditioning resulting in habitual patterns has been going on for quite some time. And each time we fall into this conditioned reaction, we actually reinforce this habitual pattern. So then it becomes more likely that next time we will fall again into this habitual pattern. So even if a person has all the outer freedom that one can imagine, like a millionaire who just can get everything he wants, who can just do everything she wants to do, but such a person is still not really free, because such a person is most likely still under the mercy of their conditioned mind. Of course, in terms of license, this person is free. This person enjoys great freedom. But in terms of spiritual autonomy, this person is still a slave to their conditioned reactions in their mind. The process of meditation can also be described as a process of deconditioning, a deconditioning of the habitual patterns that govern our minds. And you probably also know that recent research has shown that even on the physical level of the brain, it is actually possible to change the neuronal reactions of the brain with mind training, with meditation practice. So, speaking of freedom, speaking of spiritual freedom, this means the freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion, and all the many variations of the defilements. And this freedom can be gained through persevering and discipline practice. Unfortunately, this kind of freedom does not fall from the sky as a gift of grace. In regard to, you know, the practice that we have to engage in regard to the perseverance and effort that we have to put forth, the Dalai Lama has said the following thing. And this is actually already quite some time ago when he said it. It was in 1989, so like some 30 years ago. At that time, he had said, within a short time span, it is impossible to change all our concepts or the entire attitude of our mind. It needs constant application. Speaking from my own small experience, from the age of about 16 or 17, I began to make some serious effort to change and improve my outlook. Now, at 55, some 39 years have gone by, several decades have passed, yet the result is not yet satisfactory. We do have to work hard, and that is the reality. I consider myself to be very fortunate to have met quite a number of people who have become free, who are liberated. Persons such as the Dalai Lama or a number of nuns and monks in Burma. And each of these encounters was a very deep and profound experience. Of course, none of these persons claimed to be fully liberated. And of course, I also, I am not in the position to say whether or not this is true. But for my own personal experience, I can say that there was really something very special, something extraordinary in these beings. And what struck me most in these outstanding people was the sense of calm or peace and serenity that emanated from them. And it almost felt tangible. So being in the presence of these people, it was like being in the midst of a huge lake whose water were completely still, not having one ripple going over the surface of the water. And it felt as if there were no limitations, no restrictions, no boundaries. Before my first personal encounter with the Dalai Lama, I met other people who had a personal meeting with the Dalai Lama, and they talked about it as this meeting being kind of a wow experience, that it was really special, unusual, and it almost blew them away. But for me, it was not this kind of wow experience. But it was an experience that was rather subtle, gentle, but extremely profound. I remember so clearly my first encounter with the Dalai Lama over 30 years ago. It was in Dharamsala, in India, where he and many Tibetan refugees live. So coming into his immediate presence, I was only standing kind of one foot in front of him, I was immediately engulfed with this, in this space of calm, of serenity, of peace. And in that moment, a thought arose in my mind, which was, this is normal. This is what a normal human being is like. We, all the unenlightened persons, are not normal or insane, with minds not functioning normally. And after that, I gave him a mala, a rosary, to have it blessed. Somebody told me I should take something to have it blessed by him. And so then he did this little ritual, taking my rosary into his hands and reciting some blessings and blowing on it. And after that, he handed it over to me. It was a very beautiful and deep, profound experience. Another being in whose presence I felt this big space of peace and calm was a Burmese Sayadaw. It was Shwe Umin Sayadaw. Maybe you know Sayadaw Utechania. His teacher was Shwe Umin Sayadaw. He passed away 18 years ago, and before he had passed away, I had gone to his monastery meditation center a number of times to pay respect to him, sometimes taking some foreign meditators who were practicing at our center, sometimes simply going with Mimi, my Burmese friend. And so on one visit to him, it turned out that it was just a few months before he passed away. So Mimi and I went to pay respect to him and to offer him a set of robes. And as we entered his room, quite a big room, there was already a Burmese family in there who had also offered him a set of robes and some other things. And in Burma, you know, it's quite open and fluid. So if somebody's already there in the room, you simply go in and also sit down and listen and wait there until it's your turn. So Mimi and I sat down, and Shwe Umin Sayadaw was talking to this Burmese family for quite a while. At that time, my Burmese was not yet so good, so I could not understand everything he was saying, also because he spoke very softly. So at times it was really hard to even hear what he was saying. But it was just so beautiful to sit in there and, you know, sitting there again. There was this calmness, this peacefulness, this spaciousness. And after talking to this Burmese family, it was like giving a little Dhamma talk, they did the dedication and sharing of merits, like for what they had offered to him. And there is a certain chant in Burmese that is recited to do this dedication and share it. Dedication and sharing merits. And so Mimi and I joined in this recitation. This is also very natural. One simply does it. Rejoice in other people's generosity. So we chanted along this recitation. And when the recitation reached the passage, "May we swiftly attain to Nibbana," It was for me, it was like being thrown into this unconditioned state for a moment. So Nibbana, complete freedom, was no longer a state that maybe is achieved sometime in the future, but it was something right there in that moment, in that present moment. So we should never forget that the ultimate goal of the Buddha's teaching, liberation, inner freedom, this is actually closer to most of us than we think. We simply need to make ourselves available for the opening of the heart, for the understanding of things as they are to happen. So it's not so much, you know, attained by wanting it to happen, but it's by doing the practice with an open, clear, receptive mind that it will happen when conditions are right. Because otherwise, if we could make it happen, of course, we would have made it already a long time ago. Mutta was a nun, a bhikkhuni, at the time of the Buddha, who experienced the ultimate freedom. Like, she became fully liberated. A description of her awakening can also be found in the Therigathas, the verses of the nuns. And I will finish this talk with her verse. So freed, so thoroughly freed am I from three crooked things set free, from mortar, pestle, and a crooked old husband. Having uprooted the craving that leads to becoming, I am set free from aging and death. Let's sit quietly for some moments. Thank you for your kind listening. And now let's recite the sharing of blessings. Dedicate and share all our goodness that has arisen from our practice, that has arisen from our life, being alive in this world and doing much good. So really appreciate our own goodness and happily share it with all beings. Through the goodness that arises from my practice, may my spiritual teachers and guides of great virtue, my mother, my father, and my relatives, the sun and the moon, and all virtuous leaders of the world, may the highest gods and evil forces, celestial beings, guardian spirits of the earth, and the Lord of death, may those who are friendly, indifferent or hostile, may all beings receive the blessings of my life. May they soon attain the threefold bliss and realize the deathless. Through the goodness that arises from my practice and through this act of sharing, may all desires and attachments quickly cease and all harmful states of mind, until I realize Nibbana in every kind of birth. May I have an upright mind with mindfulness and wisdom, austerity and vigor. May the forces of delusion not take hold, nor weaken my resolve. The Buddha is my excellent refuge. Unsurpassed is the protection of the Dhamma. The solitary Buddha is my noble guide. The Sangha is my supreme support. Through the supreme power of all these, may darkness and delusion be dispelled. So may the practice of the Dhamma lead you to complete inner freedom, the freedom from greed, hatred, and delusion.